And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. She led the kind of life movies are made of, rubbing elbows with the likes of Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, attending Columbia University at a time when most black women worked as maids, visiting China shortly after Mao's revolution, and fighting alongside African leaders for freedom from colonization. Eslanda Cardozo Good was a journalist, a scientist, an anthropologist, an activist, and she also happened to be the wife of the legendary actor Paul Robeson. Essie, as she was called, had an identity well beyond that of Mrs. Paul Robeson. She had a fascinating and controversial life of her own, and that life story is documented in a new book by Barbara Ransby, professor of African American Studies and History and director of the Gender and Women's Studies Program at the University of Illinois Chicago. The book is entitled Eslanda, the Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. Barbara Ransby joins us now with more about her new biography. Barbara, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I read your book, I was thinking this is one of the most remarkable people that I have never or almost heard of, almost never heard of. How is it that Eslanda Robeson's story is not better known, at least until now?
Well, I think she suffers from what a lot of women historical figures suffer from him. She was married to a man who was in some ways larger than life, and she was in his shadows in terms of how historians have viewed her, but certainly the reality of her life was one of great accomplishments, a great independent voice, a fiercely independent voice. But I really think that she has been kind of in the footnotes and the margins, because the way we look back at history, we look for the larger than life figures. And so, you know, once I began to map her story and tell her story, I mean, she lived a pretty amazing life, yeah, a pretty extraordinary life. But I think it was in some ways overshadowed by the story of, yeah, Paul Robeson. People felt they knew something about Paul Robeson. There was Eslanda. That was the end of the story. But there was a much bigger story to be told.
How did she come to catch your attention as a biographer?
I encountered her when I was doing other research, actually many years ago. I was an undergraduate at Columbia University in New York, and I was working on something for a professor. And I came across her name in the archives at the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture in Harlem. And I thought, who is this woman? So I wrote a little article about her, you know, as I say, many years ago. But she stayed with me. I was curious about her life. And actually, when I finished my earlier biography and I was sort of looking for another project, I thought, let me see what folks have written about Eslanda Robeson, assuming there was a biography that I just hadn't, you know, gotten a chance to read. And there wasn't. And so I took up the task. And it was a really fascinating process.
What was the most surprising thing about her that you discovered?
Well, some of her independent travels. I mean, certainly she was an architect of her husband's early career. They traveled together because of his celebrity and performances around the world. But she took a number of really pivotal journeys on her own, and they were transformative journeys. And they were without Paul. You know, she traveled to sub-Saharan Africa in 1936. She travels to the Congo in 1946, to the Belgian Congo and French Equatorial Africa, and really arduous conditions. So her toughness and her willingness to go out into the world as a woman in an era when that was pretty difficult and unusual, I was inspired by that.
It seems that she was feisty, that she had a real passion for helping the oppressed, and it sounds like she came back by that honestly based on her family.
Yeah, I think a number of things contributed to that, and she had a period in her life, I think, where she wasn't a particularly political person, but I think she was sensitive to issues of suffering and oppression. Her own family background. Her grandfather was a Reconstruction era politician who stood up for his beliefs and was a victim of the post-Reconstruction racism that chased a lot of black officials out of office throughout the South. He spent time in jail on trumped up charges, and that story was told in the family, and Eslanda repeated it many times. And so she had a feistiness about her. She said, my grandfather went to jail for his beliefs, and so I'm not going to let anyone push me around. So that was a kind of spirit in her personality. But I think, you know, being in Harlem in the 1920s and then being in Europe from 1928 to 1939, they lived in London. You know, her worldview expanded, her real perception of injustice in the world and sensitivity to it deepened, and she made a career out of speaking out against oppression and injustice, mm-hmm. particularly colonialism.
Well, she attended Columbia University, as did you, but at a time when most black women were domestics at best, and here she is at Columbia University. I mean, this was a woman who was ahead of her time.
Yeah,
in many
she was.
Ways.
She was. She and Paul met when he was a law student at Columbia University, which was also quite unusual. She finished her degree at Teachers College. She had attended University of Illinois, which is actually my home institution now. She had attended University of Illinois, the Urbana campus, when she was a young woman, decided she wanted to move back to New York, which is where her mother was at the time, and finished her degree at Columbia Teachers College in chemistry, and worked in a chemistry lab, in a pathology lab, actually, at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. So she had the idea that she was going to go to medical school, and then she met this amazing man, and, you know, as history would have it, her life took a different course.
Yeah. How'd she meet Paul Robeson?
They met in Harlem in 1919. It was an amazing time in Harlem, in the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance, a lot of creative energy, a lot of black people from around the country coming to Harlem. So it was a very exciting time. They had a common social circle. They met. They were friendly. They didn't immediately, weren't immediately attracted to each other. But 2 years later, they were a couple. They married and, you know, began a 44-year partnership.
What was it like in Harlem at that time? You talk about, you know, the progressive thinkers, the artists. Who was there and what might life have been like for her in that place in that time?
Right. Well, you know, we know the names. You know, Langston Hughes was a friend of theirs. Zora Neale Hurston at a certain point, Augusta Savage, Jesse Fawcett. And also Walter White, who was one of the leaders, early leaders of the NAACP, was a part of their circle before they left the States. Harlem was just this vibrant community. I mean, there was enormous creativity and energy. There were parties where, you know, people who would become legendary performers would, you know, play their music. So they were a part of that milieu, and I think it was a very exciting time. There was a lot of talk about the injustices that persisted for black people in the South and the North, and there was talk about what was happening in the world at the time. Now, I must say that at that time, Islanda was not immersed in the political discussions as much as the creative and artistic community and discussions that were going on, but that would that would soon change.
Well, and color consciousness was a big part of her life from an early age, wasn't it?
Yes. She was a very light-skinned black woman. She could have passed for white. She was mistaken for a white person at different points in her life. And she made a point of really rejecting a lot of the color bias that existed in the African-American community. But she wrote about it in her fiction, much of which did not get published, unfortunately. Yeah. But she wrote novels and plays where she grappled with the color line and the process of passing for white and the pressures on African-Americans to embrace a kind of race-based racism, really, colorism in the black community. Yeah. And she spoke out quite a bit against that.
And, you know, that's all the more remarkable when you think of her being a light-skinned black woman, someone who could have passed, as many people did in that day, or at least tried to do, that she did not take the easy way out.
Mm. She did not take the easy way out and went even further. I mean, I think to embrace Africa.
Yeah.
At a time when many black people were not doing that, were really reticent to embrace an African heritage. I mean, we have to remember when she began taking classes at the London School of Economics and when she traveled to Africa and began writing about the dignity and beauty of African culture, the intelligence of African people. It was a time of enormously racist stereotypes and mythologies about Africa as a dark continent, Tarzan comic books and the like. And so she was really pushing back against prevalent racial views of Africa and a certain African aesthetic, dark skin. She talked about the beauty of dark-skinned people in Africa that she encountered. And that was a kind of cultural subversion as well as political pushback against the racism and the anti-black and anti-Africa sentiments of the day.
So eventually they end up in Europe. They start off in Harlem, they end up in Europe because of Paul's career?
Yes. They leave in 1928. They actually travel to London in 1925 and spend some time there, at which time they meet an interesting cast of characters, including Emma Goldman, who's a famous feminist and anarchist, and Claude McKay, who was a famous poet who was living in France at the time. But they moved there for 11 years in 1928. And it's really in that time, in the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s, that Aslanda Robeson's worldview expands, explodes. She meets people from all over the world who are passing through London, and she begins her own travels and writing. And so it was a very important time. She comes back to Harlem in 1939, a very different woman.
Yeah, and in the midst of this, she and Paul had a son.
They had a son in 1927, and so they all moved there together. This is Paul Robeson Jr.
Although I got the sense that her mother really did most of the child rearing in those days when she was writing and even dabbling in some acting and meeting with all these fascinating people.
Yes. Well, her mother, who had an enormous influence on her, was a formidable person, to say the least, became the primary caretaker for their young son during a number of years, about 10 years. Of his life, and so that was a real support for Essie.
So how did her thinking change in those years as she met some of these very dynamic and even controversial personalities? How did her worldview change or expand, at least?
Yeah, historians often say, often encourage people to resist thinking of moments of change, right? But there actually are some moments with Essie Robeson that I could map a real change in her thinking. 1932 was an important year. She and Paul were having difficulties in their marriage. They were planning for, not just contemplating, divorce. Mm-hmm. She goes to Paris that summer, which was great place to go if you're in turmoil and wanting some stimulation and comfort, perhaps. But she went there actually to obtain information for the divorce, to obtain evidence for the divorce, because this is, it's before no-fault divorce. So she and Paul had agreed on the divorce, but she had to obtain evidence of infidelity. And so she goes to Paris that summer. She obtains the evidence she needs. And she, in the process, meets this amazing array of French West African artists, activists, scholars who are living in Paris that summer. And she really makes a commitment as a result of those meetings that Africa and African freedom is going to be a part of her life's work. She meets René Maran. She meets Paulette Nardal, who is a Martinican woman who held a salon and was the editor of a publication, Black World. And she, she began to ask them questions about where they came from, about their experiences, under colonialism. And she really deepened her own sense of commitment to Africa and to anti-colonialism as a project. The other really pivotal trip for her was 1936. 1936, she goes to Sub-Saharan Africa for the first time. Yeah. And it's the same year that Italy invades Ethiopia. It's the same year that one of her dear friends who had been her guide to Paris in 1932, Kojo Tuvalu Haunu, dies in a Dahomeyan jail, unfortunately. But she goes with her young son to South Africa and then to Uganda. And
well,
it's just an eye-opening experience, yeah.
Indeed. We want to talk about her travels and also about her very unconventional marriage when Radio Times comes back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Starting your own plants from seed is not for the timid. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to produce plausible plants, if you can accept that sunny windowsills are horticultural horror shows, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
The The Painted Bride supports WHYY and presents A Piece of Living History as Bill T. Jones revives his avant-garde roots by restaging Body Against Body, a series of small-scale duets addressing race and sexual orientation, February 21st through 23rd. Both conceptually and physically rigorous, the dances take on new life through Jones' diverse company. Pre- and post-show events offer historical context into these duets of Bill T. Jones and the late Arnie Zane. Info at paintedbride.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we are talking about the life of the wife of Paul Robeson, Eslanda Robeson, and that is the title of a new biography. It's called Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. What a remarkable person she was. And the author of that book is Barbara Ransby, who joins us here in the studio. Barbara, thank you again for sharing this amazing story with us. Let me invite our listeners to join us if you've got questions about this remarkable woman and her life. The number is 888-477-9499. Barbara, when we left off, we were talking about a couple of very interesting things. One was her marriage to Paul Robeson, and also her travels and how they really changed and expanded her worldview. And you mentioned at one point that she and Paul Robeson were on the brink of divorce. What happened there? Because they ended up not divorcing, but they had a very unusual marriage, to say the least.
They had an open marriage, and in 1930s they teetered on the brink of divorce. They had decided to divorce. Paul had fallen in love with someone else and wanted a divorce. Essie was initially reluctant, initially devastated, but the other relationship didn't work out. And I think in some ways, Paul realized the love he had for Essie and the need he had for Essie and the partnership that they had built together and the value of that. And Essie certainly wanted to preserve it. But I think their marriage took a turn at that point, and they agreed that they would both have other relationships if they so chose. Paul, because of sexism and celebrity, I think had more relationships than Eslanda did. But they were always a family, and they remained in their marriage for 44 years. They remained intellectual partners and political partners, in a sense, in a very explicit sense, political comrades, if you will, for the duration of Essie's life.
That arrangement would be pretty remarkable given the time. I mean, at any time, but given the time we're talking about.
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, they're in this international arts community. There's, you know, Emma Goldman, for example, who's in their circle in the 1920s as an advocate of free love. There are a number of people in their community who do indeed have open relationships, and I think we forget, for example, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, who are renowned as a very stable, committed, you know, couple in the arts, African American couple, in their joint biography talk about their open marriage for a number of years. Ossie, of course, has passed on, but they were also friends, younger friends of Essie and Paul. So it wasn't as unusual as one might think, but indeed, it defined their lives. They adjusted to it, and Essie really looked outward for defining herself, for her fulfillment emotionally, intellectually, and otherwise, as much as she looked to the relationship. Mm-hmm. So I think that was another sustaining factor.
Were you surprised at all, given her level of feistiness and independence, that she was okay with that arrangement?
Well, as I read her letters and her journal, she left extensive journals, by the way, and so this is always what a biographer feels like, a bit of a voyeur, because you're reading very, very personal notes about someone's life at difficult times, happy times. So Eslanda Robeson made her peace with it. She didn't accept being treated in a way that she felt was disrespectful. In fact, she asserted this notion of being Mrs. Paul Robeson, that I'm Paul Robeson's wife, we have this partnership, we are a family, I insist on being treated respectfully. Yeah. And that was her bottom line. But I don't think she lost or compromised her feistiness. I think she made a decision that relationship was important enough to her that she would have it on the terms that were possible. I don't know that it was, in retrospect, a huge compromise for her, in fact, mm-hmm. because she also had her freedom.
Yeah. So you mentioned that she ends up in colonial Africa, having met with some of these thought leaders of the time in Europe and being exposed to people who would talk about their experiences under colonial rule. And so now this becomes a passion for her. And she travels to Africa. What happened with that?
She does. She is, at first I just, you know, want to reiterate, she's studying African societies at the London School of Economics under very famous anthropologist Bronislaw Malinowski. Jomo Kenyatta, who is the future president and leader of the independent nation of Kenya, is one of her classmates. So she's getting a deepening intellectual appreciation for African cultures while she's in London. She decides, but she hears a lot of racism in her classes, and she resists this idea of Africans as primitive, what she considered, you know, racist views of Africans as backward and not equal to Europeans. So she said, I want to go to Africa and see for myself. I want to go and connect with my people. So she travels in 1936 with her young son at the time, which is quite unusual. She travels to South Africa and then to Uganda, where she does her anthropological research for several months over that summer. In South Africa, she attends a historic conference in Bloemfontein, South Africa, 1936. She meets some of the legendary figures of the South African freedom struggle, A.B. Zuma, Z.K. Matthews. These are people who become a part of the leadership of the African National Congress. And she really sees life under colonialism in South Africa at that time, and she's deeply moved. She visits some of Johannesburg's notorious mines. She talks to people, ordinary people, as well as people who are rather privileged, people who have had education and training and so forth. And that amalgam of experiences really transforms her view of what her life's work is going to be. She then goes to Uganda, and she lives in a very small village in Uganda, a village called Kabarole, for the rest of that summer with her son. You know, it's very basic conditions, difficult conditions. She's living in a house without the kind of facilities that she was normally accustomed to. She's eating foods that she was not accustomed to. She's out of communication from her family and friends for this period of time. But she immersed herself in the experience, and she wrote quite eloquently about it in a 1945 book that she published called African Journey. But she comes back with this deep understanding and this deep commitment to the project of African freedom.
Well, and you mentioned her writing, because she really did quite a bit of writing, mm-hmm. it sounds like, although not all of her work was published.
Right. She was a very prolific writer. She starts writing in the 30s. She writes a biography of Paul in 1930 called Paul Robeson Negro. She then writes this 1945 African Journey book, which is a very important book for her in terms of her gaining credibility as an Africanist, as someone who has some expertise about African cultures. And then she co-authors a book called American Argument with Pearl Buck, the Nobel Prize winning China expert in 1949. So those are her major publications, but she publishes all kinds of essays and articles in popular publications, in progressive and left-wing publications, in African-American newspapers. And then she submits many things that, of course, are not published, and gets some pretty painful rejection letters at some point, but she's totally resilient. She gets one rejection letter, and she says, oh, thank you so much for all that you've given me. She said, I'm a girl who takes criticism and uses it as fuel to go forward. Yeah. So that was the kind of spirit that she had.
Very resilient.
Yeah.
Was there friction with her and Pearl Buck?
Well, there were differences of opinion, and I would describe some of that as friction, yes. And it plays out in the book, really, because they were quite candid about their opinions. American arguments could have been, you know, arguments between Pearl and Essie, right? Because they differed on their political worldview. They differed on issues of race and privilege. They differed on issues of monogamy and sexuality. And so it was really a thinking out loud of these two very interesting and amazing and strong-willed women in the dialogue in that book.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones for a moment here. We'll start off in Easton, and we'll welcome Jean to our conversation. Hi, Jean. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning. Paul Robeson Jr. has written a couple of volumes about his father, and he has been resistant to others writing about Paul Robeson. I wonder if your guest met with any resistance from Paul Jr. writing about this land, or was he helpful?
Okay, so the question, Barbara, was did you run into any resistance from Paul Robeson Jr., that the caller said that he was reluctant to have others write about his father. Did you encounter any resistance from him?
No, he was helpful to me, in fact. And I think perhaps it was the moment that I approached him. He was completing his own two-volume biography of his father. Martin Duberman had written a book in the late 1980s about Paul Robeson, which I think it's fair to say the Robeson family and Paul Robeson Jr. was not happy with. But I think in his own two-volume work on his father, he had his say. So he was helpful to me in writing this book. I think he wanted his mother's story told. We had an agreement that I would have access to the papers. We also had an agreement that I would write what I felt I had to write as a biographer, and that, you know, there would be no veto or there would be no
censoring.
No censoring. Yeah. So it was fine.
Yeah. You were talking about her travels and how pivotal this Africa experience was for her. Talk about what was going on in the world at that time. And it seems that also around that time, her interest and Paul's as well in the Soviet Union was percolating.
Yes. Well, in the 1930s, I mean, I'm a historian, so every decade is unique and every decade is interesting and exciting and ripe with all kinds of potential. But the 1930s was a time when they were not only interested in Africa, but also interested in what was happening in the Soviet Union, as many people were. Of course, the Bolshevik Revolution was in 1917. And so over the decade and a half that followed, many African Americans looked to the Soviet Union as a possible alternative to capitalism. Remember, it's the middle of the Great Depression. Capitalism was wreaking havoc on the lives of many people, and people were very desperate economically. So many people looked to the Soviet Union as a socialist experiment in hopeful ways, and the Robesons did too. Paul Robeson once said that his connection to the Soviet Union came through Africa. And I think what he meant by that was many of the African students that they met in Europe, many of the people that Essie met at the London School of Economics, were also talking about the Soviet Union as an alternative to the West, as a possible supporter. And the Soviet Union did, in fact, in different ways, support some of the anti-colonial struggles that were going on in Africa. So that was their interest. So they traveled there. Essie's two brothers actually moved to the Soviet Union. One of them stayed there. One of them stayed there only for a short period of time. And their son, the Robeson son, went to school there briefly.
Well, and I remember, too, reading that there was a certain comfort or relief in living in a what they perceived to be a non-racial society.
Right. Both Essie and Paul talked about that, talked about the experience in the Soviet Union of a society where at least official policy was anti-imperialist and anti-racist, and they didn't experience the kind of racial insults and humiliation that they experienced on the streets of the United States, for example, and to a certain degree on the streets of Europe as well.
And was it true that you mentioned their son going to school in the Soviet Union, that one of Stalin's daughters was a classmate?
Yes.
Of his?
Yes.
How interesting.
Yeah.
And so They spend some time there, and this is not making other people happy. I mean, certainly at some point they attract the attention of the U.S. government. There are people who are thinking that, you know, they're becoming controversial. They are supportive of the communist regime. Tell us what it was like for them in that time with the views that they had and knowing what, you know, the views were back here in the United States at that time. What was it like to be them in that situation?
Right. A lot of the discussion of the Robesons as internationalists, for example, focus on the Soviet Union. I think that's an important part of the puzzle, and it's an important part of their political identity at that time. But what I try to do in the book a little bit is to really shift the focus from east-west to north-south, that the experiences in Africa were as important as the experiences in the Soviet Union and China. For example, when Eslander Robeson is called before Senator Joe McCarthy's famous Senate Committee on Subversion, his anti-communist Senate Committee, she's asked, you know, why am I being called. And the answer was her 1945 book about Africa, which called for African independence. So it was the idea that they had a relationship to communism and to communists, but it was also their outspoken views about race and about colonialism, for which they were persecuted and indicted. And, you know, as you know, and maybe many of your listeners know, they lost their passports in 1950 for much of the decade. They were monitored by the FBI. They both had an extensive FBI file. When Essie is traveling in Africa, in the Congo and French Equatorial Africa in 1946, the British intelligence service is actually following her and maintained files on her. And you know, one of the reports describes her as a very dangerous customer, meaning that she was advancing what they termed the very outrageous idea that Africa should be ruled by Africans. Mm. So it was both their relationship to communists and socialists, their trips and connections to the Soviet Union, but also their anti-colonial stance that caused brought them attention from the U.S. government.
Did they ever claim to be communists?
They said they were not communists explicitly, but they also, Paul said that, you know, he had an appreciation for scientific socialism. He was an ardent critic of capitalism and made no apologies for that. They had friends who were in the Communist Party. They were not in the Communist Party. Ben Davis, who was a leading black communist at the time, who went to jail under the Smith Act, was a friend of theirs, and Essie wrote the intro to a book that praised Ben Davis. Essie was also friends with Claudia Jones, who was an open member of the Communist Party. So they didn't apologize about having friends who were communists, of being critics of capitalism, and being people who saw socialism as a hopeful alternative.
How did they reconcile that with what Stalin was doing in that part of the world, the purges, all the murders that were taking place? How did they reconcile those things?
Well,
they
didn't. Well, they didn't explicitly. I mean, this is often a question. I mean, they didn't speak out explicitly about the purges. How much they knew about the purges is a question. Remember, in the climate of that time, you know, there were a lot of accusations about the Soviet Union, and so other people that I talked to who shared some of their political views said, we just didn't believe it for many years. We didn't believe some of the accusations. And, of course, you know, much of what was charged turned out to be true. But I'm not sure how much the Robesons knew. I'm also not sure if they knew a certain degree of what was going on, what they felt their speaking out might do. And I would imagine the degree to which they knew about what was going on in the Soviet Union that they disagreed with, there may have been arguments and debates among people who supported the Soviet Union about that, about getting the truth, about challenging some of the crimes of the regime. But we're just not sure how much they knew.
Yeah. And of course, at some point, they really do catch the government's attention to the point where they paid a price for what they believed and for their travels. And very briefly, because we're about to go to a break, but you mentioned about how she testified during the McCarthy era.
Yes.
And was pretty defiant in her testimony.
Oh, she was indeed. It was July 1953, and she goes to Washington. She's summoned to come to Washington to testify before the Senate committee. There was also a House committee the House Un-American Activities Committee is what Paul testified before a little bit later. But in 1953, she testifies before Joe McCarthy's committee. And she's asked right away if she wrote the book, African Journey, all by herself. And she first takes offense at the question. She says, of course I wrote the book all by myself. Do you think I'm not capable?
I'm going to stop you right there, Barbara. We're going to take a break and we'll come back and we'll pick up right where we left off when Radio Times comes back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents Dialogues and Divergences, the ongoing evolution of Black Jewish relations in America, Wednesday, February 20th at 7 p.m., featuring Sarah Lomax Reese, President and General Manager of WURD Radio, along with distinguished scholars and authors as they take on this complex subject, in partnership with Penn's Jewish Studies Program and the African American Museum in Philadelphia, with support from the Arlene and Stanley Ginsburg Family Foundation. Tickets at nmajh.org.
It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
On the next Fresh Air, Tony Kushner talks about writing the screenplay for Lincoln, and Wes Anderson talks about writing the screenplay for his film Moonrise Kingdom. Both screenplays are nominated for Oscars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An entrepreneur has an idea. Have towns seize underwater homes and sell them back to owners for less. Mortgage holders are not happy. Also, Karen Russell's critically raved about new short story collection. Where does she get these ideas? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Barbara Ransby. She is the author of a new biography about the wife of Paul Robeson. It's called Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. And indeed, she did live a large and unconventional life. We have been hearing just the fascinating stories about her travels, about her thought processes. And Barbara, when we left off, you were talking about her testifying in 1953, before the subversion subcommittees in the Senate, and how she came with a rather defiant attitude toward that whole process.
Right. And, you know, I think it's important for us to remember the witch hunts that went on in the 1950s, the persecution of people for their political convictions. And some people who didn't have subversive or radical views were persecuted just at the hint of being critical of the United States government or dissident, having dissident views. So Eslanda and Paul were both persecuted, and as I said, were under surveillance. So in 1953, she's summoned to speak before Senator McCarthy's committee. She goes in and she is insulted by their very first question. As I said, she's asked whether she wrote a book in 1945 that calls for the end of colonialism. She says, absolutely, I wrote it. And, you know, she goes on to talk about her experiences. Now, she takes the Fifth and the 15th Amendment. She asserts the Fifth and the 15th Amendment in the hearings. Fifth Amendment, of course, is against self-incrimination. The 15th Amendment, what's that about? Well, it's about black people not having, you know, black people getting the right to vote, right? Having the constitutional right to vote. It's a Reconstruction era amendment. And the Senate says, well, why, you know, Senate committee says to her, well, why are you invoking the 15th Amendment, obviously? You know, you don't know the 15th Amendment has no place here. She said, oh, absolutely it does, because many of the senators on this panel come from southern states where black people cannot vote. And so she basically sort of flipped the script to indict them rather than accepting their authority to indict her for her political views. So, you know, it was an interesting moment. She was clearly defiant and insulted at this, and spoke out and wrote about McCarthyism and its impact on other dissident Americans at that time.
The 50s were a rough decade for both of them politically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You mentioned that they lost their passports.
They lost their passports for 8 years. They were returned in 1958, a famous Supreme Court case, Kent v. Dulles, which determined that people cannot have their passports taken or their travel restricted because of their political views. And so they were able to travel after that. But also Paul was blacklisted, as many people were. He lost much of his income. He was not allowed to perform at certain venues. And they lost their house. They had a beautiful home in Connecticut that Essie absolutely loved and took great care to restore. And they were forced to sell it as a result of the discrimination that they experienced during the 1950s. But, you know, they were very tough, and she was very tough. And I say, you know, in a way, they were confined to the United States in the 1950s. But for Essie and for Paul, you know, they still engaged the world. Eslanda was a correspondent at the United Nations. She wrote for a number of publications about all that was going on in the post-war world. She wrote about Korea and Algeria and Cameroons and India. And so she was engaging with diplomats and activists who were coming to the United States, and she was engaging through her writing with a myriad of global issues, even though she herself was not mobile at that time.
Yeah. And at one point she visited China as well, right, after Mao's revolution?
She does. You know, one of her last trips before the passport is taken, perhaps one of the reasons the passport is taken. She travels to China in 1949, only a few months after Mao's revolution. She goes first to the Soviet Union and then to the People's Republic of China. She goes for a women's meeting. She meets with Madame Sun Yat-sen, Sun Qingling, and other Chinese leaders and activists and intellectuals. And one of the parts of that trip that I found very interesting in her journals and diaries, and this was a real insight into her thinking. I mean, she took her research for that trip very seriously. She read extensively about China. She took copious notes while she was there about what people were saying with, you know, her own questions in the margins. So she was a real serious thinker, and she was looking very closely and carefully at these monumental changes that were going on in the world. You know, in some ways she stood on the precipice of history. Yeah. She really witnessed major historical changes. When she came back from China, she also went on a speaking tour and spoke about her experiences there and the hope and potential she saw in that part of the world at that moment.
Yeah. So after they get their passports back, it's what, about 1958?
It is.
At that point. And so now the civil rights movement is kicking into high gear here in the United States. And what was their role and how were they involved in that?
Well, because they had been blacklisted and because they had been maligned by the United States government, I think some civil rights leaders were a little bit reluctant to embrace the Robesons. Interestingly, they go in 1957 to a national march, the prayer pilgrimage, which happens in Washington, D.C. that year. And it was kind of ironic that Paul was not invited to be one of the speakers on the podium because he was this enormous stature of an artist and someone who had spoken out so courageously against racism. But it was some of the anti-communism of the time that led to them not being more fully included. Mm-hmm. But they both speak out. They attend meetings and marches. They Essie, for her part, writes extensively about the civil rights movement. She applauds Martin Luther King's leadership. She applauds the emergence of the sit-in movement. They're in the United States until 1958, and then, of course, they go for several years to London. So they're not here at a critical moment, mm-hmm. but they're still watching very carefully, and Eslanda is both watching and writing. She reaches out, for example, to Daisy Bates, who is the leader of the Little Rock struggle, the Little Rock Central High School desegregation struggle. She writes about that and other events that are happening.
Were they involved with Malcolm X at all?
They weren't involved with Malcolm X. In fact, Malcolm X apparently wanted to meet with Paul Robeson. That meeting was never took place. Malcolm was, you know, assassinated mm-hmm. actually before that could take place. But Essie did write a eulogy to Malcolm X after his assassination, mm-hmm. reflecting an appreciation for the militant stand he took against racism. She said, "I disagree with some of his views, but certainly he was a militant voice."
Yeah. What are some of the lessons that we might learn from her life? I'm just curious to know what you think about what we can learn and also what you think she might have thought of the United States as it is today, about President Obama, all of those things. But we'll start with what lessons can we take from her life?
Right. Well, it's always hard to transport, you know, a historical figure to a different time. It's so tempting. I think some of the lessons are, first of all, the dangers of repression, of political repression. The McCarthy era is one that took its toll on many people's lives, including the Robesons. And so I think we have to be very attentive to any suppression of dissent, any persecution of people because of their political views, because we see where that can go. I think also Essie Robeson is a very powerful woman figure, and because of sexism in our society, which persists to this day, despite many women in powerful positions, we look back at history and we still disproportionately look to male figures and male voices. And so part of the lesson with her story is the importance of women's leadership in history and contemporary times. She was a part of a large network of amazing women who operated on a global stage, who supported each other, who wrote and spoke out and demonstrated and thought creatively about what was happening in the world. And we just know too few of those stories. So I think those are a couple of the lessons. I guess the other lesson is the importance of internationalism. We do have a black president now, something I'm sure Eslanda Robeson and Paul Robeson, you know, thought you know, they didn't ever see it in their lifetime. I'm sure they could not have imagined an America that would have a black president, given the racism that they saw during their generation. But I also think, you know, because we have a black president that represents the country and the world, one might say, well, that's the black voice on the global stage. But it's really important, the kinds of grassroots solidarity movements that exist now, that existed then, to continue. Essie Robeson's example of building solidarity across borders, I think, was very admirable. And one thing we didn't talk about is her relationship with Indian independence leaders, with the Nehru family,
yes,
and the close relationship she had with Vijayalakshmi Pandit, who was the first woman secretary of the United Nations General Assembly, was a close friend of hers. So that solidarity across cultures and across borders, that embracing of a notion of global citizenship, I think it has so much power and resonance today. And I hope that, you know, that comes forward.
Yeah, she really was ahead of her time in that respect and many others. What do you think she would make of the progress that's been made in the United States for women, for people of color, for other minorities? How do you think she might take stock of things at this point?
Well, I certainly think there has been progress, you know, in terms of political leadership. There's been progress in terms of what we call de jure racism and legal sexism, legal gender discrimination. But of course, you know, part of her politics were also class politics, and she was concerned about people at the very bottom. And so I think today she would have questions and critiques of people who have the mantle of leadership, and she would be asking some very important questions about issues like mass incarceration, growing wealth disparity, you know, some of our own country's activities in terms of foreign policy, you know, drone attacks and targeted assassinations are things that I can't imagine an Essie Robeson not speaking out about. So So I think she would be optimistic about certain aspects of the progress, but I think she would be very engaged and very critical of, you know, of other injustices that certainly have persisted.
Barbara, I was amazed as I read your book at the level of research, the level of detail that was there. Tell us about the process for you of pulling this book together. What was that like?
Well, you know, I wrote another biography 10 years ago on a woman named Ella Baker, and it was a very different process. I mean, Ella Baker did not leave personal diaries. She did not do extensive personal correspondence. And so in a sense, this was easier in that there was a wealth of information in the Islanda and Paul Robeson collection, which is at Howard University at Moreland Spingarn archives there. But I really didn't want to just use her voice, and I wanted to also see how she, you know, how her voice played out in other places and where she appeared in other archival collections. So I was able to get material from the Berlin Robeson Archives in Germany. I was able to get material from the South African archives at the University of Witwatersrand. I was able to get material from the Nehru Memorial Library in Delhi. Now, it sounds like a wonderful travel experience. However, because of technology, I was actually able to get materials without traveling to all of these places. I did travel to some of them, and I had some wonderful students who happened to be based at different places around the world who were surrogate researchers for me. So it was an exciting project to put together the pieces, you know, of this absolutely amazing life. I must also say, you know, the photographs in the book tell a story as well. You know, the people that she encountered, the speaking engagements, the meetings, the travel. She met Martin Luther King in London in 1961, for example. She's she's with Henry Wallace during his campaign in 1948. All of these people who animated and populated her life are reflected in some of the photographs that I was able to collect. So that was a parallel research project, also, you know, is to really try to locate many of the visual images of her life.
Yes, the photos are amazing and tell a story in and of themselves. How long did it take for you to pull all this together?
It was a 6-year project, and I was doing other things at the time. You know, I'm also an activist and I teach, and so I was not totally 100% immersed, but it was a 6-year project with periods of intense immersion over the course of those 6 years.
Yeah. What are you, who are you looking at as potentially a next subject for your work, or what are you thinking about next for yourself?
Well, I'm catching my breath. I have not decided on another project. I mean, many things interest me. The question of global solidarity interests me, and that the history of solidarity across borders and different people and organizations that have been a part of that tradition. I'm also directing something called the Social Justice Initiative at University of Illinois Chicago, and that's a project that's really trying to bridge university and community around issues of social justice. And so that kind of engaged scholarship is something that is very near to my heart and is something I'm going to devote a lot of time to. So the next book project I'll decide on, you know, in the next year, but right now I'm not working on one.
Yeah, I know you've touched on this perhaps in an earlier response, but as you look at the life of this woman, this Eslanda Robeson, what do you think her legacy is?
Well, I think it's a legacy of resilience. I think it's a legacy of kind of a defiant and principled adherence to one's views despite persecution. I think also what I admired about her life was a kind of spirit of compassion, but also a love of life that she never seemed to lose. I mean, despite difficult times, despite a complicated marriage, despite her very serious health challenges, she was someone who also always had a sense of humor. She's someone who always was generous toward the people that she loved, the people in her life, and conscientious about that. So there was that about her personality that I think is a part of a legacy. But it's also a legacy of global citizenship, of someone who really saw her political family as people in India, as people in South Africa, as people in Costa Rica and Cuba, all over the world. And she maintained close relationships to many of these people through her correspondence. Yeah. So I think that's probably what I'd say is a legacy.
Her story speaks to the power of one, doesn't it? The book is called Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. The author is Barbara Ransby. Barbara, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. What a fascinating book this has been. Barbara, by the way, is professor of African American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thanks again for being with us. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and our producers have been Patty Leswing, Susan Greenbaum, Dennis Devine, Debbie Builder. Kevin Griffin is our engineer today, and our engineering supervisor, Joyce Lieberman. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.